Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly Podcast. It's for the week of February 8th. It's brought to you by One World Sports. I'm John Gibson, and with me is Jamel. What's happening this morning?
Well, we've been having technicians in at Podcast Plaza here, Podcast Plaza Koenji.
the new and improved version.
One hopes.
Congratulations on your move. Sorry I wasn't able to assist you.
Well, that's because I didn't tell you. I don't like to bother people unless it's, like, really fun.
All right. So I guess I'm just not the life of the moving party. All right. I got it.
Well, yeah. Well, we had you know, my niece and my sister-in-law were over here lending a hand, and my brother-in-law said he'd come next time to eat soba with us, which apparently they did every night they were here helping. Oh. We went to the soba place.
All right. Well, congratulations on your move. Now,
thank you.
On this week's show, we've got a chat with former Dragon and three-time batting champ Alonzo Powell, and we're going to talk about the opening of spring camps, Kazuhiro Kiyohara, and a whole lot more. So let's start swinging.
Clearing the bases.
All right, so this was a really fun interview for me. I got to sit down this past week with Alonzo Powell, and you know, he was born about 2 weeks after I was, the same year. He was born up in Northern California, up in your neck of the woods. So
yeah, he's from San. He grew up. I don't know where he was born, but he grew up in San Francisco.
All right, so he played for the Dragons from 1992 to 97, I believe, and then I think he went to the Tigers for a short stint in 1998.
Yep, traded.
Yeah. And he,
he was traded. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure how the transaction went. I remember a trade. I remember him not having a good time at the Dome. So I remember a lot of things. But anyway, he won CL batting crowns 1994, 1995, and 1996, so he won three straight. He hit 325, 355, and 340 in those seasons, so that was great for him. He was on the great Dragons teams that finished second three times when he was there, but he only won one Player of the Month award and was an All-Star twice. So that just kind of seems kind of weird. But one quick sidebar about Alonzo. This is the kind of guy he was. He's a great guy. Great personable guy. He was always out in the community and everything. So one day, I don't know if you know this, but there's a park that's right next to Dragon Stadium.
Nagoya Stadium.
Right next to it where you go where the player's entrance is at the back entrance. You've been there, I'm assuming, so I know.
I have only been to Nagoya Stadium once. That was to ruin Kenjiro Kawasaki's career.
Another story, another day. But anyway, they have some ball fields out. There's a park, and there's some ball fields out there where kids play baseball, and there's some adult leagues that play on the weekends, and right in the middle of it is this round basketball court. It's near the fence, near the street, and that's near the players' entrance. So one day, it's such a small court that the 3-point line for your court that you're shooting on is basically the half court line.
Okay,
that's how small it is. So we're playing out there because you know how sometimes, especially in the 90s, it's hard to get a gym. It's hard to you have to rent a gym, find people who want to play, get them all there at the same time and play. So sometimes we would go and play at this outdoor court just because it was convenient. So we're out there playing maybe a 3-on-3 full court game because, again, it's such a small court. Full court really isn't that long anyway, so you can do 3-on-3 full court. And I hear this voice from the street, and it says, "Don't let me get on the court. I'll show you I'm a two-sport athlete." And it's Alonzo. He's heading into the ballpark. We ended up never playing ball together. You know, he's challenging me out there. He's saying, you know, "I could beat you, man. Don't let me show you. I'll take you out. You know, I'll show you. I'll take care of you." And we never got to play, but he's just friendly that way. You know, he's on his way to work to play a game, and he sees us playing. So he, you know, because you have to park inside the gate there, and he had to walk back out, basically, to come and yell at us. So he's a really, really fun guy. And
he told me that if he had a choice, he would have played basketball instead of baseball because he thought baseball was boring.
I didn't get a chance to tear him up on the court.
Yeah.
And make him realize he made the right decision.
He was still talking to you.
You made the right decision, though, to play baseball. But it was fun. It was fun. It was a fun time when he was playing there, and we had a fun chat. So let's take a listen.
All right, joining us on the show this time, we're very pleased to have Alonzo Powell, the former three-time Central League batting champion for the Chunichi Dragons. How you doing, man? It's good to talk to you again.
Oh, I'm doing great, John. Thanks for having me, and I'm excited.
All right, so you are starting your gig with the Houston Astros this year. You're going to be working with Trey Hillman. What's your relationship with him now these days?
Trey, you know, I've known Trey a long time now. When after my playing days in Japan, I signed with the New York Yankee organization, and Trey was my manager, and in Columbus in 1999. So I was fortunate to play for Trey, and then when Trey became a manager in Japan, you know, of course, with my ties of Japan, I found out before it was announced here that he was going to be the manager in Sapporo. Or it was Nippon Ham at the time, I think it was.
Right.
Before he even went over to Sapporo. Right. And so I called him up and I said, hey, Trey, I heard you're going to manage in Japan. And he's like, how did you find that out? I'm like, Trey, I played in Japan 7 years. I find out a lot of things that happen in Japan. So, you know, it'll be really, yeah, you know, it'll be really nice, though, to work with Trey. You know, I'm going to learn a lot from Trey. And, you know, hopefully he can, you know, teach me some of the things that's made him successful, you know, as a manager and as a bench coach. And, you know, that's my goal now as a coach, to try to keep continually to learn.
All right. Well, you played for, you had a really good career in Japan. You won 3 straight Central League batting titles. And looking back, how did you pull that off?
You know, honestly, you know, John, I don't know. You know, I just, you know, I went out, I tried to play hard every day. You know, I went through a couple of years there where I had some nagging injuries and I wasn't able to stay on the field as much as I would like to stay on the field. But, you know, one thing that, you know, I can honestly say is in my 7 years in Japan, I left everything on the field. You know, I played hard. You know, I played with some injuries. And, you know, I was a little bit lucky. But at the same time, you know, I thought I understood Japanese baseball, so I was able to give and take, and you know, and I think that kind of made me successful in Japan.
Now, how many times during those seasons did you feel like teams just were trying to pitch around you so much and didn't want you to actually be successful against them? Or, and I know you always told me, hey, that, you know, you're always, when you're the foreign player, especially in the 90s, you know, nobody wants to lose to you, so they're already not giving you good stuff to hit. But how many times or how many stretches during that time did you feel like they were really trying to avoid you as a batter?
Well, there were certain times and certain parts of the game where you got the feel where, you know, you weren't going to get quality strikes to hit. But, you know, I was very fortunate. You know, I was on a very good Chunichi team, and we had some really good players up and down through our lineup. So, you know, you just have to understand the way the game is going. And if you're willing to take your walk, you know, you take your walk and you let your teammate try to, you know, come through. You know, and then there's certain times where, as a hitter, you have to go outside of the strike zone and get a hit. You know, it's kind of a fine line. But, you know, those are things that you got to make an in-game split decision. You know, which way do you want to go with it? But, you know, I always try to, you know, if I had the opportunity to take a walk, you know, I would take my walks and leave it up to my teammates. You know, like I said, I was fortunate to have some really good guys around me in our lineup that were really good players.
And you guys ended up finishing second place a bunch of times. I know I called you the bridesmaids a lot of times, but what was the thing that was lacking on those teams to get you guys over the hump? This is back before you had the playoffs system, so you guys were unable to get that championship. What was up with that?
I just think it was a little bit of unluckiness. I mean, you know, the 1 year when we lost that big game to the Giants, you know, the back end of our bullpen wasn't solid. We lost a lot of games late that year where, you know, I still think we had the best team in the league that year. And a couple of the other years were, you know, injuries. You know, whether it be myself or our pitcher, you know, we missed some games. And in the Central League, you know, back then, you know, only the winner went to the World Series. So every game was important.
Right.
And, you know, I just think it was a little bit more of, you know, the injury factor. And we didn't play consistent all of the time that I was there. You know, again, we had great players. And, you know, I wouldn't trade any of those years in for anything. But, you know, that's one thing that does, you know, kind of live with me a little bit. You know, I'm a little bit disappointed. And, you know, my 7 years with the Dragons, you know, I wasn't able to help the Dragons get to the World Series.
Yeah. You know, what difference might the playoff system have made back then? Because you guys would have been in a bunch of years.
Well, you know, obviously, you know, once you get in the playoffs, you know, as you see in America, you know, that even the wild card teams with the one game play in have gone on to win the World Series. You know, once you're in, anything can happen. And, you know, with some of those teams that we had, you know, we were playing really great baseball at the end of the season when it counted. And if we could have got in, you know, anything could have happened. But, you know, those weren't the rules there. So, you know, like they say, you can't cry over spilled milk. You know, we knew the rules, what they were. But, you know, it would have been interesting, you know, if the rules were what they are today.
Yeah, I agree. Now, you played under Seiichi Hoshino for a while. He's a real fiery guy. What was he like in the clubhouse? Because we saw him, you know, I always said he's a guy, you got to keep him away from open flame. What was he like in the clubhouse with you guys?
I mean, I never had a problem with Mr. Hoshino. You know, he's a hard-nosed guy. You know, I would kid with the other our other American players. I would say he's Japan's Bobby Knight. You know, he loves you. He'll do anything for his players. You know, I've seen him, you know, in the last few years and talked to him. And, you know, he's always asking me if there's anything that he could do to help me out. You know, he loves his players. He wanted to win. You know, he's a fiery guy that wanted to win. And, you know, he's that type of guy that kind of wore his emotions on his sleeve. You know, if you saw that day, that was Mr. Hoshino. But, you know, I never had a problem with Mr. Hoshino. And, you know, and I just, you know, thank him for everything that he helped, you know, helped me with while I was in Japan.
Yeah, I know he, you know, he popped a few of his Japanese pitchers, one of whom was Eiji Ochiai, and I've heard stories of more, but how did he treat the foreign players in general?
I mean, you know, I was never witness to any of that stuff, but, you know, he treated the foreign guys with class. You know, he was always nice to us, anything that he could do, you know, to help while I was there, you know, whether it be a recommendation on dinner, or even buying dinner. You know, he believe me, he bought me a mini a dinner while I was in Japan. Hey, you need to go over to this yakiniku place today. And I would take my interpreter, or I would take the other foreign player who was on my team, and we would go out. But, you know, nothing but first class. I mean, like I said, I have no bad feelings with Mr. Hoshino. I mean, he was very, very nice to me. And, you know, I have no complaints.
Oh, yeah, you know, he kind of turned into a little bit of a teddy bear when he went to the Eagles, and they actually got him that Japan Series title, so that was really nice for him. That was a really good moment with Masahiro Tanaka helping him, you know, be a winning manager. That was really nice. All right, so you were playing obviously in a situation where there was no interleague play. How monotonous was that for you, and was it a good thing, or is it a good thing now that they have it, or do they not need it? What's your opinion on that here in Japan?
Well, I mean, it's good and bad, you know. For us, again, you know, those were the rules. You played the same five teams. I would like to say it was, you know, I think 20 to 25 times each. And, you know, the only bad thing about it was you had to face the Giants pitching for 25 games, you know, versus missing out on a team, you know, that the pitching wasn't as strong that you can kind of, you know, maybe, you know, have a little bit more success. But, you know, hey, that's what it was. And, you know, you learn the other team. You know, you learn those pitchers. You know, you learn those catchers. And as a player, you know, that's how, you know, that's what makes you successful. You got to learn tendencies. You got to learn what different pitchers like to do. And believe me, we saw those guys enough. So, you know, you learn how to make different adjustments to different players. And, you know, hopefully, you know, you get lucky there.
Now, I remember you showing me basically a sabermetrics sheet, but, you know, they didn't call it that. This is back in the 90s, where you gave me all this data that the team would hand over to you when the pitchers would throw this particular pitch in this particular situation, or their tendencies and all that stuff. How much was that useful for you, and how much is it useful for foreign guys coming over?
Yeah, I mean, it's very useful, but, you know, it's with any amount of information that you get or gather, if you don't know how to use the information, it's not going to do you any good. You know, yeah, you could know whoever's throwing a first pitch slider every time. Uh-huh. If it's not a strike or if it's not in a location that you can handle it, you know, you can't swing at it. You know, you still got to understand what your strengths are as a hitter and what location in the strike zone that you can do some, you know, potential damage in. You know, those are the things that make you successful as a player. You got to understand your strike zone, and you got to understand your area that your success rate is a lot more beneficial to you as a player.
Yeah, I just, you know, I looked at that stuff and I'm like, oh man, that's an information overload. You know, my brain would explode trying to remember that stuff at the plate. Did you ever feel that way?
No, not really, because I was an aggressive hitter. You know, I like to swing early in a count. I look for certain pitches in certain areas, and if I got those pitches, you know, early in a count, you know, I was ready to swing. And, you know, I also had enough patience to where at certain times, you know, I could wait guys out and battle with two strikes and still find a way to get a hit. You know, it's just, you know, I think the key is confidence, being able to go up there and not panic and have the confidence that you're going to be successful at home plate.
All right. Now, in this day and age, we've got Facebook, we've got Twitter, we've got all the internet and all this other stuff, but when you were playing here, you didn't have all that stuff. How did you communicate and have that foreign player community, that big tight-knit group that you guys had? Because it seemed like you guys were really close. How did you guys stay close?
Well, you know, we all looked at the schedule and we based everything off of, you know, there would be certain times in the season where, you know, there might be six teams in the Tokyo area at one time. And we would look at the Tokyo area as kind of a meeting place because everybody kind of played at the same time. The games were usually over around the same time. And we would call each other at our hotel, our respective hotels. And we would say, hey, after the game, let's meet at, you know, either Hard Rock or Tony Roma's in Roppongi. You know, that was a central meeting spot. Then, you know, we would figure out where we wanted to go to dinner that night. And we'd kind of sit down and talk about, you know, how things are going with everybody and, you know, exchange a little bit of information that we did have on some of the other teams. And, you know, that was our way to, you know, we all spoke English, obviously, but, you know, that was our way to kind of get together and relax and have a little camaraderie.
Yeah, it just seems like, you know, we think back and it's so easy now. It seems like it was impossible. But how did you actually, like, get information on the other players and find out who's doing what? Did you guys watch the news and watch the replays at night as well?
Yeah, you would watch the replays, and you know, and I, you know, had the Chunichi Sports delivered to my house, you know, my apartment in Nagoya, which, you know, obviously is in Japan, but you know, I learned to read the box scores, and I knew everybody's name because you see it at the scoreboard and every stadium that you go to, so you learn the names and you learn how to read the box scores and to see how guys are doing and, you know, who's playing well, who's not playing well. So, you know, those are little things that you learn, you know, while I was in Japan.
All right. Well, I've been asking this question to all the guys, so I'm going to ask you as well. We see you on the bench there in the States. When are you going to be, or is it possible you might be on the bench here in Japan as well?
You know, I was in Japan in November, and I was in Nagoya. And
you didn't call me?
Question. It was a quick thing. I was doing a whole bunch of things.
All right.
Well, now I got your number, so I won't mess up next time.
All right.
But you know, I would. You know, honestly, John, I would love to coach or manage in Japan. If I was offered that, I would probably stop what I'm doing right now and do it tomorrow.
Huh.
I mean, that's how much appreciation that I have for Japan and Japanese baseball. You know, hopefully, you know, down the road, you know, something does open up, and you know, I would welcome the opportunity to coach or, you know, possibly manage one day in Japan.
Yeah, I could see you and Ichiro on the same bench.
Yeah, that'd be nice. that'd be really nice.
In Nagoya, no less.
Just, you know,
back in his home.
I'm so proud of Ichiro. You know, I think I told you when I was in Japan, he's the best shooter I've ever seen.
Yeah, yep, yeah.
He's made me look like a genius.
Well, I don't think you needed that much help, man. You've been great on your own.
I'm rooting for him. You know, I think he's, I forgot how many, I think he's 65 away.
Yeah, he's
like that.
Yeah, it's going to be. It's going to be a Michael Jordan.
Close, so.
Yeah, it's going to be a Michael Jordan type watch this year for him to get to 4,000. So we'll be watching that too. All right, man. We appreciate your time very much. I know this is your private time before camp opens. Good luck with the Astros, and we're expecting big things from that team as well.
So, yeah, I'm excited. You know, it's a good group of young, talented players. You know, we've made some key additions over the winter. You know, playoff team last year. So, you know, the sky's the limit. I'm excited. You know, I can't wait. I'm glad to be a part of it. And, you know, and I can't wait.
All right. Well, we can't wait to see you again. So let us know next time you're coming out to Japan.
Will do, John. Thanks a lot. All right.
Thanks a lot. Take it easy.
Okay.
Wow, that was cool.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Alonzo. The Bobby Knight of Japan. I like that line. He's talking about Saint Chile.
Yeah, sounds like he wanted to instill a little fear. You know, I think that was a sort of practical joke.
It's just a persona. I'm not really this way, right? Well, you scared the dickens out of me for sure.
It's a great analogy, I think.
Yeah.
I think it's a little off, but then, you know, America ain't Japan.
Yeah. All right, so what stood out for you in this chat?
Well, a whole lot. I thought, you know, at first I'm thinking, wow, when's he ever going to get to anything specific? And it kind of stayed that way most of the time. You know, he sort of like, it reminded me of going to a Japanese restaurant. Where you see the plastic food in the window and you say, wow, they got this, they got this, they got this, and then when you get in, but they don't show you any of the actual food. They told you what was on the menu, but you didn't get to taste any of it.
Right.
You know, it was like this, it was like that, and I just really wanted some specifics, and especially, this got even more so at the end when he was talking about the coaching, because one of the things I really enjoy talking with the guys who want to coach here is specifically what they have in mind and their opinions of it. You know, he said, you know, I know about how Japan works and I absolutely believe that, but tell me how you see the dynamics. Tell me how you see it working. Tell me how, you know, what can you do within that framework is what I really wanted to hear. And I didn't get any of it. So I was a little disappointed in that, but you know, it's sort of like, it's like a really good, you know, you get to the restaurant and you have the meal and you're disappointed that you weren't able to eat it all.
Oh, okay.
It's quite good, but it's sort of like, oh, maybe I should have ordered something else on the menu or he could have cooked it the way he did last time or something. It was that sort of feeling.
Mm.
So, anyway, I did enjoy it and I wanted to think a couple of things. First of all, I want to say that you asked a really good question about his use of the data, because this is the way you asked it, I thought was very clever.
Hmm.
And when I say that, I sometimes don't think a lot of the way you ask about the usefulness of data, because you can't keep the little voice. And
only you hear that. I'm just letting you know. Only you hear that.
I know. But so often it's sort of like asking plumbers what they think of art history. You know, it's like questions that are really related to what they do. But in this case, and this is an area which I have a great interest in. I think we share this. You know, the Japanese teams tend to do data overload, I guess, and because they can.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it just seems like death by digits.
By digits. I think that must have happened to me in former life.
Yeah, could have. That explains a lot of things. So, anyway, we had a good answer for him, which was, you know, find what is useful for your approach and your abilities. And I think more or less everybody has said this, given us the same answer, or given you the same answer. I usually don't ask that question.
Mac?
No, but it's true. I mean, Josh Whitesell said, you know, he looks for the type, you know, sort of the kinds of pitchers and the kinds of results he's getting in his numbers as overall trends. And I remember other players in this case looking for what, you know, what the guy might throw on a first pitch, you know, what can you expect early in the count. And that little bit about his approach, I'm going, okay, what's next? And then no more.
Right.
I guess a better analogy for the restaurant is we got the appetizers. We got the menu and we got the appetizers. Man, that was really good. Oh, sorry, that's it, only appetizers.
See you next time.
So, yeah, I enjoyed it, and I've really only ever had one conversation with Alonzo Powell, and that was back from the 1997 season.
Uh-huh.
After I wrote a year and a half before I was working at the Daily Yomiuri, and at that time I was writing the baseball previews for the Japan Times.
Mm-hmm.
In which I said that Yasuaki Taiho and Alonzo Powell were both coming off super 1996 seasons, and they were both 32, and they were, I think, for both of them, it was their best years. You know, it was like their career year. And I said, you know, they're both 32, they're coming off years that are higher than their norm. It's very unlikely they're going to be able to put the two of them together are going to be able to produce the same. And Alonzo didn't think it was, you know, appropriate for me to be writing that in English where his friends and family would, you know, think I was dissing him.
Right.
I wasn't dissing him. I was dissing, you know, the fact that this happens to players as they get older.
Right.
Anyway, so Marty Kuhnert saw me. I was with some friends at a card show. The only time I ever went to a card show. And Marty Kuhnert was selling off cards at that time, and he said, "Jim, Alonzo Powell wants to see you, and he's not happy with what you wrote." You know, it was like I hadn't heard that tone of voice since I think I was in second grade.
Yikes.
So I went to, and Alonzo expressed his displeasure, but he did it in such a, you know, it was like he was angry, but he was angry in such a way that you said, "Yeah, what a classy guy."
Right, right, yeah. Well, you know, he's always been he's been a no-nonsense guy since I first met him. And, you know, I remember one of the lines he told me. I think I repeat it on the show all the time. Well, not all the time, but in the past I've said it.
Yeah, you say it all the time.
The pitchers have to throw the ball over the plate, and we have to hit it. And that's all to it. You know, it's very much what's going on. They have to find the plate, and when they get in the strike zone, hitters have to attack it. So. But I love how he called Hoshino Mr. Hoshino. It just shows that he's very much him,
yeah.
Yeah, he does things in a classy way, and he still has respect for that manager, and for even if I don't think, I personally don't think he was in agreement with every decision that Hoshino made, but he certainly respected him, and that's genuine respect, and I think that's Alonzo.
Yeah, you don't find people, you know, agreeing with each other 100% of the time like we do.
Hashtag I hate you.
What did I do to you this morning, man? Just waking up early, wearing all these shots.
No, that wasn't a shot at you. That was just this is the way things are, you know? You enjoy the variety.
All right. And one phrase he used in there, I'm just going to, you know, keep ducking. One phrase he used in that conversation was that...
You're in my sight line, man. You got to stay out of the way.
Yeah, somehow.
Yeah, I got no safety on this thing.
Safety. All right. Safety first. One of the phrases he used in the chat was good strikes to hit. And I thought that was another guy sneaking a fastball past us, because a lot of times you look at batters and you're like, you know, why didn't you swing at that? That was right down the middle. And I remember last summer when I went to talk to Julio Franco, remember when I went up to watch him play in the independent ball last year, and I was watching him in a game, and he takes a 1-0 pitch, and it was right down the middle, and he didn't flinch. He just didn't pick, he didn't swing at it at all. After the game, I said, hey, Julio, you took that 1-0 pitch, and it was right down the middle. It looked like a home run ball to me, and he says, hey, that was a changeup. I don't want to hit a changeup. I want to hit a fastball. And so it brought me back to Andrew Jones always saying, I'm looking for my pitch, and guys sitting on pitches, but just the act of guys sitting on pitches. And when you say good strikes to hit, not every strike is something that you need to be swinging at. Some of them are not the pitch that you can handle, not the pitch that you can drive, or not the pitch to hit in that situation, or not the strike to hit in that situation. And I always tried to ask Alonzo when we would get together, I'd try to put some scenario together. What do you try to do in this situation? Two on, two out, this inning, and I could never, he never answered the question. He would always say, well, who's pitching? Well, who's on deck? Well, what's the count? You know, if it's this inning, where are we? Are we at home or on the road? He never answered the question. He just made me narrow it down to the situation.
Well, he didn't tell me how hot it was.
Well, that makes a difference. There's just too many factors for him to actually answer that question. I mean, it just, because every situation is different. Even if they look the same, even if they feel the same, they're just different.
That's so true. I mean, and of course, and I don't want to be mean, but the fact is, you never know. You never know what is the best course to take. You only, and I think when you're there, you make, you know, you know, he probably doesn't take all those things into consideration, but he feels them, you know, and that's the difference. If he has a sense of where he is and what the situation is, and okay, goes with it. He's not out there with his pocket calculator like Japanese baseball in the 70s. And I'm not joking. I'm only joking because they didn't have pocket calculators on the field at the time. They would have if they could have.
I bet they would have. I also found it interesting that he said, hey, I'd drop everything that I'm doing right now and come over. I thought that was, I've been asking this question, and I apologize to the listeners. I'll stop. I think this was the last time. I won't ask anymore.
Okay, I'll do it for next time.
But I thought that was an interesting answer. I didn't expect that. I expected more along the lines of, someday if the opportunity arises, blah blah blah. But you know, I'd drop everything today and be able to.
I think there's a point at which you become so, what's the word I'm looking for? Immersed.
Mm-hmm.
That I mean, Japan leaves, you know, foreign places you enjoy living and leave a mark on you. And there's a point at which you feel the call to return, you know, at some point and finish, take care of unfinished business or do things, or you see things that you have answers for and you want to do something about it. And I think 6 years or 7 years is certainly probably past that point for him. I think Alex Ramirez passed that point after about 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
Wilson Valdez passed it after the first day and then realized it was a wrong turn. He wanted to marry a Japanese and live here forever until they benched him.
Slick Lily. Yeah. I remember that situation. All right, let's make a seamless transition into spring camps. They opened on February 1st, and as you noticed, we didn't really make that much of a big deal about it in the last show, and I never do, and I say this each year, so why should this year be different? There's still pockets of snow on the ground in Tokyo right now. I don't feel spring training. I feel cold. That's all I feel. And it's just too early. I've seen this craziness on TV where I have cable, so you've got 5 channels broadcasting with commentary on spring training, and guys are doing nothing but going through calisthenics and running around in the outfield. I don't get it. I love baseball.
Maybe.
I love baseball, but that's not baseball. That's just guys running. You know, I did that this morning. I ran. I got up early and I ran.
Well,
where were the TV cameras?
Actually, I knew that because it was on J-Sky Sports. I didn't want to
my workout for the media. So, you know, it's, you know, there's not really that much going on. Guys are just, you know, taking some batting practice, throwing some bullpens. I mean, even on TV, you've got a guy throwing a bullpen, and all you can see is his body. You can't see where the ball's going.
You don't focus on the pitcher.
He's just throwing, so you get to look at his form and see if he's in actual good form, if his back is straight enough, or if he's one of those jumpers we talked about last time. I don't know. I don't get it. I just, yeah. You know, it's a little bit crazy for me.
Well, when you invest so much in baseball, you gotta. You gotta broadcast it, I guess. They've got the rights, so they're gonna do it. They got nothing else on.
Well, you know, because right now every team is in first place. Everybody looks like a championship team.
Okay.
Hey, right now, sure they do.
Yeah, well, that's right. If the pennant race ended today, they'd all be champions.
Exactly. So I think Louis Okoye, the Rakuten Rookie, mm-hmm. they're trying to make him the media darling. You know, he's the guy that, I guess it's a must film every move guy. That's mm-hmm. what I'm calling him. That's cute, but I don't actually see him making the first team. I think he's kind of a project in terms of, he's got a lot of physical ability, but he's got to learn to put all that stuff together. And they put him on the first team camp because I think they want to encourage him, but I don't know that he's going to be on the first team when the season starts. So we'll see how that goes.
I don't have any camp highlights. I guess my regret, you know, is that Nobuhiro Matsuda returned to the Hawks, because I was thinking about that yesterday when the Hawks were on the news. You know, the news cameras will on NHK will, you know, go from camp to camp picking up things, and they had the Hawks on yesterday, and I was thinking, oh man, bring your earplugs. with first is Matsuda barking, and then Yanagita grunting.
And
Yuki Yanagita, who probably should have been the MVP in 2014 as well as 2015, when he takes BP, and I don't know if he does it in games, and this is a question I have to ask catchers or people on the field who can hear him, if he grunts like that when he swings in games, because he's very close to Maria Sharapova in BP.
I think Monica Seles was the biggest one, though. Maria is still kind of mild.
True. Well, Monica Seles was kind of she was a pioneer in the in the guttural vocal discharge.
Hashtag high heat.
Oh, man.
So Yanagita's got that going on. And if he's batting and Matsuda's fielding at the same time, you know, it sounds like Ray Charles doing What I Say.
Little James Brown in there, too, huh?
We do, yeah.
I like the perceived battle that the news people are trying to portray between Taiga Hirasawa, the rookie with the Chiba Lotte Marines, and Daichi Suzuki at shortstop. I think once the actual batting starts, I think we're going to see Suzuki is a more polished and accomplished player, and this is a non-story. But they're trying to make
Suzuki is a hitter. I mean,
well, yeah.
If he weren't a hitter, he wouldn't be on the field.
Oh, yeah. Well, we know that. But, I mean,
yeah.
The perceived battle, they're sure. acting like this is really going to be a big deal. So I'm like, no, it isn't. I don't think so. Once we pick up the bats, we'll see something here. But.
You know, the fun thing about spring is we have all these little stories, and I love to go to spring training and pick up, you know, and just pick up who's where and what they've got to say about their new surroundings. And it is fun if you're there. And I'm glad people get to go, but the stories don't interest me unless they're really, you know, they tell me about a person.
Mm. Yeah.
And there's so many of those, but instead the story is, how many balls did so-and-so hit over the fence?
Or how many swings he took and how many were liners, line drives.
Right, and how many pitches he threw with the catcher standing in the bullpen, and how many he took with the catcher squatting. Wow. Last year I logged the number of times stories came over on the Kyoto news department about the number of pitches guys threw in the bullpen. This year, I just give up. It's overwhelming.
Yeah, but one story that is kind of interesting is Shohei Ohtani. and the Nippon Ham Fighters.
I'm glad you brought that up.
Camping in Peoria, Arizona, and it's the first time for them to be abroad with their camp in 29 years. So it just seemed to me to be a perfect showcase moment for Ohtani himself, and that seems to be going really well.
Yeah, but MLB teams were absolutely thrilled about that because they're thinking, wow. This is going to save us a little bit on our scouting expenses. except, to be honest, the hotels in Phoenix at this time of year are outrageous. So maybe probably that cancels out the cost of the airfare, the difference in the airfare between Phoenix and Tokyo.
Well, they can drive or take a taxi. But anyway, I like the fact that he's working with Trevor Hoffman over there on a changeup, and I had seen before camp started that he said he was going to be working on a changeup for this year, and I heard Andy Green, who played for the Fighters briefly in 2007. He only played in 18 games, but
I had lunch with him in December.
Yeah, he's the manager of the San Diego Padres, and he said, "Yeah, I wouldn't mind having somebody like Shohei Ohtani on our team." And
yeah.
And I'm paraphrasing because I saw the comments in Japanese, but he said he looks like he'd be able to play two ways. You know, he'd be able to go two ways.
With the Padres, absolutely.
Hashtag high heat.
Oh, someone else a target this morning. I'm so happy.
Well, actually, I want to go back and correct the image. When I said Andy Green and I had lunch, it was Andy Green and I and about six Padres beat writers. And one of their PR, two of their PR people.
Get out of here. I'm trying to have a conversation here.
But he did remind me that we had spoken, that year in 2007, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I remembered him because of his triples. He had this ungodly number of triples in 3A to avoid a little confusion there.
Mm-hmm.
And the year before it was outrageous. It was like triple man. And he could move. He could, you know, hit the ball and move. And I thought that was going to be great. But he was hurt most of the time here and he didn't adjust. And I asked him if, you know, he talked about his type as a manager. This is a complete aside. It has nothing to do with Japanese baseball. He talked about the importance of communicating with each player and getting to know them and what they want to do and what he sees they can do and, you know, and working that out beforehand. Because he's never managed before at this, I don't think at any level.
Mm-hmm.
And that may be wrong. But, and I said, you know, it sounds exactly like what Trey Hillman said when he came here. And I said, you know, it sounds like you borrowed a lot of Trey Hillman's book. And he says, hey, buddy. I'm going to go on the record. You can tell Trey this. I was a much better player than he was.
Good one. Nice shots. Andy's firing shots, too, and he's not even here.
It hasn't been since George Bush invaded Iraq that an American, a Japanese team is going to the States. So a team was going to go that spring when they invaded. And so it's taken, 14 years.
Mm.
To sort of get over that fear of flying.
Fear of flying, he calls it. Well, I'm glad. I mean, I don't know that, you know, I was thinking it's 10 years ago or before they changed, I shouldn't say 10 years because that's arbitrary, but before they changed or capped the posting fee at $20 million,
mm-hmm.
I think this would have been a great way for a team to go and show off a pitcher in the preseason and
it would be profitable, you know, if the teams could, you know, get $50 million for Shohei Ohtani as opposed to 20, it would be profitable to have him train in Peoria. And here's the thing, by the time he's posted, the system may have changed.
That's true, but it is what it is now, so it doesn't make sense.
It is what it is now, but and there's also, as I've explained in the past, the possibility that, and especially with a player of Ohtani's ability,
mm-hmm.
That he could, the Fighters could work out a deal for him, you know, say at the end of the season to say, well, we'd like to, you, if you want to go to the States, you're welcome to go if you want to buy out your contract and go over there as a free agent instead of posting. In which case, you know, they'll say, okay, $40 million, and it's, you know, and you're a free man.
Hmm.
And then everybody's a winner.
All right.
So I think there's, now they may not, the Americans may not like it, but there's technically nothing in the, they're not violating the posting system by making their players free agents.
Right. Well, something to keep an eye on.
when the whole thing with Masahiro Tanaka saying, I want to give back to the Eagles, boy, that sent the fire, the alarm bells running through major leagues. No, you can't do that. It's not what we want.
Yeah, I remember that.
So anyway, I spoke to a couple of agents and some MLB people, and they said, well, yeah, that's very likely, but we doubt that any Japanese team would be that clever to do it. And all of the fighters have a knack for being clever, so they might, and also a knack for selling players to the States, so I think they're the team we might expect to make best use of that possibility or some other possibility.
Hmm. All right. Something else to keep an eye on. Now, I guess there are no transitions for this next story. We're going to talk about Kazuhiro Kiyohara. He was arrested on Tuesday night on drug charges. Apparently, police had been surveilling him for more than a year, and he was caught with drug paraphernalia and some kind of stimulant, which has it been made public?
I think they said methamphetamines.
Yeah. I haven't been able to keep up with all the stories. It's been on TV all the time, constantly, all the news shows, all the sports shows gave up on this story right away. They're like, well, here, you take it, news. You know, we won't worry about it.
Wow, they're like I am.
Yeah. This story looks
hard to translate. You want it?
Yeah, that too. But so I woke up on Wednesday and saw that, you know, all this stuff was going on and was reading the stories, and he looked really pathetic and remorseful sitting in the back of a police car and being hauled away like a common criminal. And this is a guy who, you know, he's fifth on the all-time list of home runs in Japan, and he was a big star as a young high school player and as a Sabre Lion in their golden era. And it's really sad to see this.
It is very sad. I was never a big fan of his for a variety of reasons. He was, and I'll tell you the reason. Now, first of all, I have to get this out of the way. He was a great player. And he did this despite, I think, not being really all that smart, not having really the ability to analyze and make mental adjustments other than just instinct. But physically, or given that limit, I think he did extremely well.
Mm-hmm.
He's one of the greatest. I would say he's the second best player who's not in the Japanese Baseball Hall of Fame. He's a Hall of Famer, and I think I mentioned this in my blog, most recent blog post, which was like 2 weeks ago, that he's a very similar player to the guy who was just inducted, Kihachi Enomoto.
Mm-hmm.
A guy who didn't win a lot of, didn't lead the league in a lot of things, but he was just one of the best players year in and year out. And Kiyohara was basically a phenomenon when he was 18. I should say 19. I guess he was a rookie when he was 19. And a normal career trajectory for a player who's one of the best in the game at 19 is that he's going to be, you know, one of the greatest ever, and he certainly was. Physically, his is a guy who was, you know, a much greater physical talent than somebody like Sadaharu Oh. But his career, he never led the league in one of the Triple Crown categories, which are the only ones that anybody cares about in the mainstream media in Japan. So they said he never led the league in anything, which is not true. But he was a great player, and I think the fact that he disappointed and he failed to live up to the media's expectations bugged him. I think that his expectations to some degree became the media's expectations. He adopted them, and he went into all kinds of crazy, I mean, it's just bizarre off-season training regimens. One year he decided to train like an NFL lineman. And one year he tried to train like a professional wrestler. One year it was golf.
Yeah, I remember the wrestling one.
Yeah, and I think, how can I say this without being sued? He showed a lot of the symptoms of somebody who was using steroids.
Okay, yeah.
And I didn't write that. Yeah, he was furious at, you know, he was furious at small slights or the way people treated him on the field, and he didn't get along with the media. He had one reporter who any news about Kiyohara that wasn't at a press conference came through one guy he would talk to, who then shared it shared some of that with his colleagues. I never got the feeling he was a bad person or evil. I think he was just he just really loved baseball, and then when he got out of the game, it just really killed him. Yeah. He didn't have anything left.
Yeah, I mean, he looked like that. He was out of shape. He had a big tummy. And you know, I've seen a lot of stuff on TV. I've seen a bunch of articles. I can't keep up with all the people who are writing articles, and I won't even try. Most of it's in Japanese, and I've been trying to read it. And but I must admit that, and you brought it up, you touched on it, saying that he showed symptoms.
Sad.
Yeah, it's very sad. You said that he showed symptoms, a lot of symptoms of someone who might have been using performance enhancing drugs. I wrote it in my blog post that the rumors dogged his career and parts of his career. So it didn't really come as a shock to me that he might be using something. But what does come as a shock to me is that the police would surveil him for more than a year.
Yeah,
he's not a big drug kingpin or anything, I don't think.
Yeah, I think that's why the big thing that the police are leading on, or, you know, you never know, this is chicken and the egg here, but my guess is they figure he's connected to something, he's part of a larger chain.
Which is what I suspected right away.
From somebody they're following. I think that was sort of just a way in the door, because obviously it doesn't make sense to investigate a former baseball player for, you know, to be staking out his apartment for a year for a user for methamphetamines. It defies logic.
Yeah, it does. And so that's what I thought. Exactly.
I hear you.
I called it a sad chapter in his career. And it's a sad thing for baseball. We did get one comment on the Twitter feed, and that was from Naija Gambare, and she said he screwed up many chances of getting clean. This country definitely needs more rehab centers.
Yeah.
And so that was a very good comment. And then
I find a lot of good comments coming from that Twitter account, actually. Mm. Of course, that's because they're often, oh, nice article. That's the way I work.
All right. And then the commissioner, Katsuhiko Kumazaki, had some very eloquent comments, one of which was,
that's a first.
I'm at a loss for words. Baseball is one of the sports that children and young people yearn to play. And even after sports stars retire, they have to continue being role models. I thought that was very eloquent.
That is for him. And it's interesting because he's a former prosecutor, high profile superstar prosecutor who always, I think Jason Cosgrove said it best, he never says anything of any value. Yeah, he sounds like he really doesn't care that he's the commissioner of baseball most of the time.
Yeah, which is too bad. But that, I thought, you know, I looked at the comments in Japanese, and then I think it must have been your guys' work. It must have been Kyoto that translated it, or maybe it was another source. But anyway, I thought it was well done. So well, hopefully that passes. I don't really want to talk about it that much. We'll wait for some decision to come down, and maybe we'll touch on it at that point. But I'm not going to keep up with all the ins and outs of this situation.
I was asked how he's going to be treated, and somebody mentioned Yutaka Yanatsu, who had a drug arrest, and I think it was also on methamphetamines. The former Tigers,
great
Tigers, and he pitched for a number of teams. And when I asked, in a sort of off, somewhat slightly slightly different context, I asked Sadaharu Oh about this 2 years ago, and he said, look, you know, we're all behind his comeback. It doesn't affect our opinion of who he was as a player. You know, we just support him and we wish him well, and you know, and he's got to do the hard work.
Definitely, definitely.
So, all right, Sadaharu, I'll be the same. Sorry.
No problem. Okay, making a two-team transition and going to the new skippers. Now we have another crew of new managers in Japanese baseball. Three in the Central League, two in the Pacific League, but the three in the Central League are first-time managers at this level. So in the Central League, we have Alex Ramirez with the Yokohama Bay Stars. We have Tomoaki Kanemoto with the Tigers. We have Yoshinobu Takahashi with the Giants. The other two in the
Pacific. I would say it's not three-time first-time managers at this level, but three first-time managers, period.
Yeah, well, I
don't know if I've ever managed before.
Yeah, I think at least Alex Ramirez has some
he's coached.
Experience coaching.
He's the only one who's ever. Well, Takahashi was a coach. He was one of the Giants' batting coaches as a player in his last
player coach. Yeah.
But Ren Ramirez was a batting coach.
All right, so in the Pacific League, Junichi Fukuda of the Oryx Buffaloes, who was the interim manager this year, is taking over full-time in his first camp, and so we're calling that this his first full season. And then Masataka Nashida of the Rakuten Eagles, he's been around a long time, and he's taken over this team. So the thing that interested me right away was I thought we've had 10 new skippers in the past two seasons.
Which is... In my opinion, that's a miscount. I really count nine because, and I know you like to use the word official skipper, but Tanabe was a new manager in 2014, so even he was an interim manager, but
okay.
I like nine instead of ten. But
you're gonna count Fukuda. He was in a room as well.
We count Fukuro because he was new last year.
Okay. All right. So I was interested in knowing if this was the most turnover that we've seen in NPB in ever, and you looked it up for me. And
the answer is like no, and hell no.
No and hell no. But you counted, well, let's go through it. You said in 1973, after the 73 season to the end of the 75 season, there were 11 managerial changes.
Yes, that's not even the high point, of course, and the reason it's not the high point is because Japanese baseball went basically doubled in size in 1950.
Well, if it doubled in size, then that meant that there were going to be new managers anyway.
Or eight new managers.
Well, but that had to happen. That's expansion. This is people stepping away, or this is change. This is existing teams. So I wanted to discount that.
Yeah, I think you have to.
I counted that as mitigating circumstances.
I agree. And also, you know, the start of Japanese baseball. I think the other mitigating circumstance is World War II, when we had a lot of, you know, almost every year, most of the teams were changing managers because many of the managers were being called off, you know, were being activated from reserve duty to serve in the Army or the Navy. So, you know, if you discount the war years and you discount the expansion years, then yes, 1975 and 1974 after the 73 season was the big watershed year when we had wholesale changes.
Okay.
We had 11. And then we had a bunch of years. And again, I'm not counting the interim managers who stayed on, so that count actually would be higher in your book.
Okay.
After that, we had years when I counted 10, which was 1955, 1961, 1969. Okay. And then 1974 and 73 was also a big year. So we had like... From 1973, from the beginning of the 1973 season through the end of 1975, we had 14 changes.
Yeah, that's a lot. That's a lot.
So no, it was not historic, but it was a lot. It's the most in a number of years. It's the most in, I would say, since 2005 when we had 2004-2005, when we also had nine changes.
All right, so we've got all these new managers, especially in the Central League, these 40-somethings, all of them are 40 years old now.
We believe.
That's reportedly.
That's the Alex Ramirez...
I wasn't naming names.
Additional. Well, you know, he's mellowed out about that.
All right. All right, so at the end of the day, I'm wondering, my question that I threw out on the Facebook page a little while back was, who has the most pressure and expectations to meet? And I wanted your opinion on that.
How did you put that up? How come I missed it?
Well, because you don't look. But anyway.
Okay, way back.
For me, I think the guy with the most pressure, and we have included in this, is the Yomiuri Giants, who are expected to win every season. But I'm going to go with Tomoaki Kanemoto as the guy with the most pressure. And the reason is, I think, given the environment, the expectations, and the way his personality, he's been a winning guy, a winning player. In terms of preparation with the physical part, I think he's going to work his team really hard and prepare it physically. I don't know what he's going to do on the bench in terms of game management.
Mm-hmm.
But from what we've heard about the press, the stories that you have told for years on this podcast, mm-hmm. about the press being so harsh on players and for managers and all that, all the goes with being in the pinstripes of the Tigers, I think he has more of a hot seat situation than Yoshinobu Takahashi, and I'm going to say it's him.
Well, everybody I speak to, and again, I don't know anything about any of these guys' ability to manage, obviously, seems to think a lot of Takahashi, and you know, well, that could, they could be spot on. And again, as I mentioned, I saw him, you know, I saw the similar situation 14 years ago with Tatsunori Hara, and I thought he and Takahashi were very similar players, and I was shocked by how this image conscious, I'm a star, I'm a marquee player, kind of guy, as opposed to like a winner, became such a good manager. And I never saw that coming, and I don't see why it can't happen to Takahashi as well, but that's sort of, you know, like saying, you know, all cars are cars, but some are Rolls Royces and some aren't. You know, because they're similar players don't mean they'll be similar managers.
Well, the thing that I noticed with Yoshinobu is, and the reason I think he actually has less pressure than any of these guys is because the Giants have a winning system in place.
True enough.
He simply has to come in and keep the bus going. Yeah. I know he's popular, and I see him with a high. See him with a high level of job security. I don't see the Giants making a change soon because he's going to be a face of the franchise kind of a manager. So I don't think.
Yeah, I don't. You know, it's certainly true, and they're not going to fire him after 1 year. They usually wait two.
Right.
The interesting thing, although I have to say, I think there what's working in his favor is one. Yes, what you said. They have a good system in place. Two, they're going to have some talent. And as much as I love Hara, and I think he was great at mining the minor league talent and making use of it and, and giving those guys chances, opportunities for advancement, which is not the Giants' norm. He'd been there a while, and I think, you know, what he had pretty much and not worn out his welcome because they wanted him to stay, but he's no longer in a position that his system is basically not empty, but it's not helping him anymore. They need a different outlook. They need a different, you know, somebody who has a little different point of view just by being a different individual. And I think Takahashi will benefit from having a good system, but not looking at it from the same way as Hara did. So, yeah, I agree with that. As far as Kanemoto, I don't know. I get the feeling this is a guy that nothing bothers.
Yeah.
I see him as being almost the ideal Tigers manager, somebody who really doesn't give a hoot about what the writers say and can tell them, you know, go jump, you know, take a hike. And I don't think he's going to do that, but I think they're going to get the message very quickly that, you know, you don't, you know, he's, I think, as I said earlier, I think he's the guy who can protect his players. So I like that. I think Ramirez, I don't know if it's pressure, but I think he's the guy who's really the, you know, because he's the foreign manager, and he's a guy who's never managed, and he's got a lot of big, he wants to do things quite differently in the sense, not in the sense that, you know, he's a Westerner, changing things, but he's got this idea of sort of creating a fusion, you know, finding roots or finding paradigms that he can infuse Western ideas into the way Japanese players are used to doing things.
Yeah.
So they can do them differently without having to confront the shift in ideology, you know, that accompanied. You know, like when Bobby Valentine came here in 1995 and he did a compact computer commercial. Anybody remember compact computers?
I do.
We're going to change baseball. And it's like the day after that, he claims that the shutters went down and the lights went out and like they cut off his telephone in his office from talking to people.
Well, I don't think Ramirez is going to be in that situation, and I don't think he'll do poorly. And like I said before, I think he needs talent. Every good coach has talent, and he's going to need that. But, yeah, I see him as second on this hot seat list. I don't think he's going to have the pressure immediately because this team is, what, since 2002, I think it's 10 times.
Well, I think
that they finished in last place, so yeah.
I think the chances of Fukura being managing next year are very low.
Yeah.
Because it's Oryx, and somebody will use him, and Oryx uses their managers like they use their players and anybody on the staff who's part of the power play. In the power struggle between the people running the front office.
Yeah.
You know, whoever is, I would guess one person who's in charge is backing Fukura to succeed and one is backing him to fail.
Right. Yeah. And he's in the Kansai area as well. So I think he's virtually carefree though. I don't think it's a big.
No, I think so too. He's that kind of guy. Nothing seems to bother him. He's a very,
right.
Yeah, stable, level-headed guy, but I think, he's got no experience. He's got limited experience at this level. He's a head coach kind of guy, and I think essentially the fact that half of his team is rooting against him is going to preclude him from staying on.
Right. And then in Masuda's case, I think he will have the guys focusing on the process, and I think that'll lead to good results. I don't know where they're going to finish, but I think
he's a whiz at getting at basically finding guys who work within a system, and then finding a system, finding a system that'll work with these guys. And the funny thing about him is that he was a big offense first manager with the Kintetsu Buffaloes. And he moved to the Fighters. He took over after Trey Hillman left in 2007, and the Fighters were all pitching and defense.
Yep.
They had some good hitters, but they were basically a big pitching. They won in 2007, and 2006 and 2007 was basically the worst offenses in the Pacific League. It was almost unheard of how good their pitching and defense was. And here comes Mashita, who said, "I want a good offense." And I said, "Well, where are you going to find it?" He says, we'll see. And 2 years later, they had the best offense in the Pacific League. I was like, what the heck?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he changes. He's got a plan, and he knows how to work it. I think this is a different environment for the Eagles from Dave Okubo, who had a plan that he had no idea whether it would work or not or how to implement. You guys just run. run until you get thrown out.
Exactly.
That's the way it played out.
Or come home. It'll be fun to watch these managers this year. And, basically we've got a bunch of new managers, guys who are one plus or in their second season. So it should be fun. I want to keep an eye on this.
We want to see, we'd like to see something more. I think we both would like to see something more out of Koichi Ogata than he showed last year, which was, mixes up and confusions.
Off the road and into the ditch. All right, so let's transition into notes here. Lee Dai-ho signed with the Mariners minor league gig, and we've got three guys, actually. He's one of three who has signed with minor league gigs with the major league teams, and I love the point that you brought up.
This past week.
Past week, yes. I love the point you brought up on the show when we broached this topic, and I really like that you tweeted about it again, the fact that if you really want to make the jump to the major leagues, the bottom line really isn't about the money, it's about the opportunity, and he jumped at it. It's a minor league deal. I think he can earn up to $4 million, but there's no guarantee he'll make the roster. He's really going to have to fight for a position. I actually think that we know that he's the kind of guy who sits on pitches, and I think it's going to be easier for him to hit in some respects in the big leagues because
I do as well.
When there's a fastball count now and you get a fastball, I think he's going to be able to sit on those pitches and actually react. But I don't think that he's going to get that great a chance. I don't think that he's going to be able to play in the field. He's a bat or bust guy. So I actually see him being successful by sitting on those fastballs and having a chance to hit his way to a spot to get some DH time and some pinch hitting time.
I think that's accurate. I think I do think his game is more suited to the U.S. type. But I think as Matt Burton told me in December, I think he's going to benefit from having played in Japan. Where the breaking pitches are so good and having to hit breaking pitches off fastballs.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's going to really, that'll help his game when he goes to the States. I mean, he has a fast bat, which means he's going to strike out a lot. You know, he's got a big swing with a fast bat. He can shorten it a bit when he needs to. I think that's going to help him. I think he's a better hitter than people give him credit for. On the other hand, his age is not helping him. His size is not helping him. He's a smart fielder. And this is the thing, as a first baseman, he has limited value from his mobility, but he has good he's the opposite of Shinosuke Abe, or he's the mirror image of Shinosuke Abe, in that here's a guy who, you know, both guys who are not very mobile, but one guy, both guys who have good arms, but one guy who knows what to do with it.
Okay.
Lee's a former pitcher. He's got a great arm, but he's a smart first baseman. And I think that's going to weigh well. And I think that's what a lot of the major league teams look for when they sign Japanese player, is good fundamentals. And he's not Japanese, but he's coming out of the same paradigm.
Okay. All right, and then the second guy is Matt Merton. He signed with the Cubs, so
he hasn't signed with the Cubs.
He hasn't signed.
He's come to terms with the Cubs, and the word is he's in a very rare move. They're waiting on his physical.
Okay. All right, so when he signs, or if he signs with the Cubs, I still think it'll be tough for him to find some time on the grass in the outfield with that team. They've got a lot of young, good players, but he and Munenori Kawasaki can share war stories, that's going to be fun to listen to Matt speaking Japanese to Munenin and Munenin speaking English to Matt. That would be a really funny conversation.
We need video
on that, so if you guys are listening, get that out there. And then Hideki Okajima is going to, I think he signed, right? He said that the Okie Dokie.
He has signed.
He's signed with the Baltimore Orioles.
Apparently did not get a spring training invite.
He didn't even get the invite, so that kind of makes sense. But good luck to him. Good luck to those guys. And let's go to fielding questions. All right, the first is an MP3. It comes from Mike in Washington, D.C.
I read an article a while back that many of the cheering sections have connections to the Yakuza. And I was really curious if you guys had ever personally experienced or seen any of that illicit activity, or knew of sort of the history that connects some of the fans and even the players to organized crime in Japan. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Mike. And this is a really good question. And yes, I've been told essentially that Japanese teams have a long connection with gangsters, and traditionally, and that's because most of the teams are
the organized cheer groups.
I'm going to get into that very briefly. And the teams do because of their, most of the teams were in construction. Most Japanese teams were originally owned largely by newspapers and railroads, and they all involved. They had business with organized crime as part of the cost of doing business. And now the cheer groups were basically originally, the Oendan were originally formed as a way of separating, of keeping, protecting the fans in the outfield from the gangsters who were betting on the games in the outfield. Okay, so, you know, and causing a bad influence. But once again, the gangsters sort of morphed into the becoming involved in the cheering groups. And I guess a lot of, especially if the Chunichi Dragons, have had a lot of trouble with keeping the gangsters out of their cheering groups. But they are rigorously screened now. The police have a list of every member, every official affiliated member of an organized crime syndicate in Japan.
Right.
I'm sure it's not 100% correct. It's probably a lot like my database. And, basically every person who goes to the ballpark and wants to wave a flag or wear a Oendan suit, you know, and be an official cheerleader or blow a whistle or beat a drum or blow a trumpet, has to have a card. they've got to basically have a little Owen Don Union card.
It's a registry, yeah.
And I learned all this from Ted Smith, who's a professional cheerleader for the Cebu Lions. And after a sterling career in Korea as a professional cheerleader for the Dinos, and if I got the Korean team's name wrong, please excuse me. And he said, yeah, that, you know, sometimes guys will be put on hold or not allowed to enter the cheer group because of their connections or because of, for example, even things like traffic violations or breaking the law. You know, even if you've got a criminal record, it's very hard to get into these things.
Okay.
So you have to keep a clean nose. So there is that.
Okay, so I don't think anyone is completely clear about the relationships between these organized cheer groups, and they are called Owendang, and the organized crime Yakuza entities with respect to individual teams. I think some teams have different associations, but in general, when I asked our Japanese reporter about it at work, and he reminded me that the NPB went through this clearing out process where they started banning all these shady elements, and this was in 2008.
Yep.
And those with definite ties to Yakuza, they were keeping them out of those organized cheer groups, and they were eliminating.
I brought up the dragons. I'm sorry to interrupt. I've been trying to be good about that.
Oh,
but the reason is that, and that's the reason why 1 year you didn't hear trumpets and drums at the Dragons road games is because the NPB had decertified cheer groups. Whose members had not submitted the documents to screen all their members.
Right.
Whose organization. So they're decertified by NPB. So that happens quite a lot to the Dragons. And there was also a case 1 year of gangsters basically trying to get, controlling the rights to cheering CDs for the Hanshin Tigers players.
Okay.
So they get in there, and of course the result of all this, interestingly enough, is that when you used to go to an NPB game, you were, from the moment you exited the station, you were confronted by people either trying to buy or buy your tickets or selling you tickets. The Dafia, a version of, you know, a branch of organized crime, and I don't remember whether it was Jason Cosby or Wayne Brassic, I had this conversation too last year when we saw people selling tickets at a postseason game, and we said, "When's the last time you saw the Dafia selling, you know, scalping tickets?" And the answer is, it's almost evaporated.
Well, yeah, it seemed like in 2000 there were so many instances of violence and injuries and all kinds of things going on with the bad elements, let's put it that way, associated with NPB, and so the league made an effort to thwart all the ties with the gangsters at that time. So they've been doing this cleaning up, and then also in 2008, the Players Association created this subcommittee to deal with these matters and to eliminate members whose backgrounds were linked to gangsters or gangs or Yakuza groups. So there's a lot of efforts that are going on, but again, I don't think anyone is exactly clear, so I don't think you can say that there's a definite ban with this team, I'm sorry, tie with this team and not a definite tie with other teams. I think it's each individual team.
All the teams have connections to some degree, you know, either through the stadium or this or that, but I was told by one of my sources that the Hawks have worked very hard to eliminate any connections with organized crime, which was hard because they bought a team that was owned by a railroad. But I've heard of it at different ballparks. You know, the ballparks come with conditions. Some of the team's ticket offices are run by gangsters because that's the way it is and there's nothing they can do about it. And team officials trying to eliminate the gangster influence received death threats and threats against their families at home, threatening phone calls at home. So this is the reality.
Right. Yeah. So that's the answer. All right. The next question is from Roger in Tokyo, and he says, "I never miss an episode. Keep up the good work on the podcast. I learned."
Yeah. Thanks, Roger.
Thanks a lot.
I never miss your questions either. Roger, I mean, you got them bring them on, Dave.
Okay. I'm not making fun of the Kiyohara situation. I feel sorry for him, and I hope that he gets the help he needs. The Japanese media treatment of drug addiction is ignorant and backwards, he says.
Oh, yeah.
But after watching the news about him, I got out my trusty, and it's his Pro Yaku roster,
okay.
And he says the book that he buys every spring to show his wife that he is that Kiyohara is the all-time strikeout leader.
Mm-hmm.
And that no active player in the top 10 is even close. Basically, he said some other stuff, and then he got down to his question, which was, and Kiyohara leads with 1,955 strikeouts. Okay? So his question is, which record is more unbreakable, Oh's 868 home runs or Kiyohara's 1,955 strikeouts?
Wow. This one came at me very late and in the middle of moving the podcast plaza. From one part of Koenji to another. I really didn't have, I wanted to look at it very scientifically, you know, give you some background, but I completely failed. So, John, what's your take on that?
My take is, Tanishige, Motonobu Tanishige, who retired after last season, is at 1,838 strikeouts, and he's
mm-hmm.
retired. As Roger said, nobody is active in the top 10. The next guy who's active is Takahiro Arai at 1,510.
Mm-hmm.
And we know he's coming, he's going to the end, toward the end of his career, which could come at any moment. So the question is a great question. I don't like to predict the future, but I would say no. And the reason is, it won't be a foreign guy, and those are the guys who tend to strike out a lot anyway in the short term time
right.
that they're here. And Tuppy Rhodes is number 7 on this list with 1,655.
Mm-hmm.
And he played from 1996 to 2009. That's a long career, and he didn't break the record. So I don't think so. I would say no, it's pretty much untouchable. I would actually dare to say that the person who breaks O's record would also have an opportunity to break this record. And so
yeah, that's interesting because if NPB mirrors to some degree MLB, you know, at some point this idea that, you know, it's all about power.
Mm-hmm.
If it comes to that in 10 years, and you can see that, you know, with the changing Japanese body type, small players like Kiyohara, and, I mean, Kiyohara was an anomaly in 1987, you know, a 6-foot guy with huge muscles who could really make good solid contact, you know, the big fast bat.
Right.
That kind of player was pretty rare in Japan.
Right.
And Tsutsugo coming up is a guy like that. And these players are becoming more and more common. Shohei Ohtani could be a player like that. You know, if he played full time, he could beat Kiyohara. So
I say no.
I say no, but I think it could happen. I think the changes, the Japanese game in 10 years, we could be looking at a game full of, you know, just big, strong kids trying to hit home runs and people saying, sacrifice butt? What planet did you come from?
Right.
Yeah, it could happen. But I don't, he's got a huge lead. And again, I think your comment about it could be the same person is absolutely right. If the Japanese game goes that way, the person who sticks around long enough to hit, you know, 890 home runs,
868.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the guy who gets that enormous total of home runs is going to be the same one who strikes out 2,000 times.
Right. All right. Thanks a lot, Mike and Roger, for the questions. We appreciate it very much.
Yeah,
and you can send questions by email to yakyujohn@gmail.com. Tweet us at #HighHeat, at JBW Podcast, or go to our Facebook page and leave us a note there. Thank you very much, and we'll see you in 2 weeks. Enjoy your spring training.
Yeah, keep watching, baby.
Live and exclusive from around the globe, America's network for global sports, One World Sports. Witness top soccer competition, including Europe's iconic clubs, Arsenal, Bayern Munich, Chelsea, and new this season, Juventus. With exclusive highlights, interviews, and analysis. Plus, NASL's greatest soccer franchise and 2015 champion, the New York Cosmos. Watch One World Sports on your TV, tablet, or smartphone. One World Sports, a sports network like no other.